She's Japan's first female warship commander, inaugurated on Tuesday at a change of guard ceremony. Ryoko Asuma will command the first escort division, comprising a warship squadron, 1,000 crew, and Japan's flagship Izumo helicopter carrier. Japan's Navy hopes her appointment will lure more women, as the country's declining birth rates and aging population fails to provide enough men.
As Prince Harry and Meghan Markle finalise the details of their spring wedding, the happy couple will be extending their wedding invites to more than 2,500 ordinary members of the public, who will have VIP access to one of the world's biggest weddings of the year. The guests will include local schoolchildren, charity workers, and around 1,000 people chosen from across the country, of all ages and backgrounds. It's not the first time the younger generation of royals have broken with tradition, as the hugely popular Fab Four work at leading Britain's 900-year-old monarchy into the modern age.
When it comes to vehicles, it's go big or go home. Major automakers this week posted lower U.S. sales for February, but it was passenger cars that dragged down the curve. Sales of Fiat Chrysler's sporty little Italian namesake, for instance, dropped a whopping 42%, while the company's Jeeps jumped 12%.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, Monday morning. Steve Grzanich, a little under the weather. My name is Mark Carmen, sitting in this morning for Steve. We will hear from Steve, don't worry. We have an interview that he did with Bonnie Siegler, who's the founder of design firm 8.5 and the author of Dear Client. That is coming up in a couple of moments. But first, let's take a look at the Associated Bank Market Desk, our early morning numbers. Everything tipping up. The Dow Jones took about a 1.75% up 440 points. Points on Friday, 25,535. The S&P up 1.75% as well, early as everything's tipped. It looks like we're going to have a big day on Wall Street. The S&P 2786. The NASDAQ at 7560, also ticking up this morning. The Russell and the VIX all pointing north, as it looks like we'll have another big day of movement. Some news that's happening this morning. This past week's stock market price action was as chaotic as the fast-moving narratives it's followed, and that's likely to continue. In early February, if you remember, the inflation narrative moved front and center on fears that rising wage pressures would feed broader price rises and force the Fed to tighten more aggressively than expected. And that narrative was born from the January jobs report, which showed a jump in hourly earnings. The report, of course, then triggered a sell-off that turned into the first correction, and that's that sell-off, of course, defined by a 10% drop or more, and that was in roughly over 2 years, first time we had that. But on Friday, the February jobs report showed a robust 313,000 jobs created, but not much wage growth. It did spark a relief rally that sent the market sharply higher on Friday, and 440 points up the Dow on Friday. As Dave mentioned in sports, the men's NCAA tournament announced its field. There was a little bit of a twist yesterday, and some teams were left out, including Notre Dame, but a little surprise among the top seeds. But for the first time, the entire 68-team field was announced at once in alphabetical order, and then they went to the brackets, which a lot of NCAA fans did not enjoy yesterday. Of course, the telecast on TBS, the individual matchups in the full bracket were eventually announced. Four play-in games start on Tuesday and Wednesday. You can watch that on True TV. And the first round games will start Thursday on CBS, TBS, TNT, and True TV. Those are actually called second round games if you can follow all that the NCAA is doing now. There's also tensions between Whole Foods Market and some of the most important brands it sells. And that's going to come to a head on March the 19th when they will congregate for a recently announced summit. Sources familiar with the situation are telling CNBC the grocer notified certain vendors about the meeting by email over the weekend on Saturday. It is set to reassure the brands of relations with Whole Foods and about the sale to Amazon. It comes after a rocky few months for Whole Foods, which have been trying to shift from a local orientation to a national one, but doing that without sacrificing the selection and relations that do set it apart from its larger peers like Kroger and Albertsons. So we'll see how that goes coming up a little bit March the 19th, so coming soon. All right, let's get into our first guest. Steve sat down with Bonnie Siegler, the founder of design firm 8 and a Half and the author of Dear Client. And this book is going to teach you how to get what you want from creative people. I do need that. So let's hear from Steve and Bonnie.
Bonnie, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been excited to talk with you because I like to dabble in the work that you do.
Oh, really?
I like to create things, and I did it freelance for a few years, and it was sort of a nightmare. So I'm interested in reading your book and going through some of the things that I kind of experienced firsthand that I bet a lot of our listeners who are doing this are going to really, it's going to hit home for them. Let's talk about the book. It's called Dear Client. Why did you write this book? Who's the audience?
Well, originally I was thinking, well, I'll go back. I just did it.
It's the beauty of it.
I've had my own company for 25 years, a design studio. And when other designers get together, when I get together with other designers, we complain about clients. I mean, we just do. It's like it's a hobby. Yeah. How they interfered, why it didn't go well, and it's always a difficult relationship. And there are lots of books for designers about how to work better with clients, but I realized there were no books for clients on how to work better with designers. And I thought maybe they're not bad people. Maybe they just don't know how to do it and how to get the best work out of us and what the work means to us. So I decided to put it in a book.
And it's wonderful the way you've sort of put it together in a list, really. It's all bullet points, very easy to go through. I finished it in about an hour, less than an hour, and each one of these sort of has impact. What are the most important of them, do you think?
Well, my favorite one is we don't care what your spouse thinks, because that's just oddly something that comes up a lot when you go through an entire process with a brief and lots of meetings, and then you get feedback about what someone's spouse thought about the project, even though they hadn't been involved at all. And it is a process. So so that's one that I particularly like and I know has happened to a million people. But I think it's also just we're collaborators with them. We're not working for them the same way an employee is working for them. And having a good relationship is crucial. If a client treats us badly, it's really hard to continue to be incredibly creative, to think about it in the shower, think about it when you're on the subway, because you don't have that love for the project anymore. So you want to have a good relationship with your design team, with your designers. And then we'll be thinking about it all the time and just want to impress you and make you happy, which who doesn't want that?
Right. And the relationship, do you get a sense that the relationship is going to go bad from the very beginning? Are there things that people say in that first getting to know you and hiring you that you know, wait a second, this is going to be a problem?
It usually happens a little bit later. In the beginning, it's like, we love you, we trust you, we want whatever you want. And then at the first presentation, it's like, I don't think so. But it's more about the daily interaction. And, you know, when you send comments back, to just make sure to acknowledge the work that went into it. Yeah. Like, we could have spent months on something, send it, and then what we get back is a list of tiny points of changes, sort of with anger, instead of some appreciation, literally, thank you, and then the comments.
You're right. It's not what you say, but how you say it is important.
Well, this goes for every working relationship, really. It's not unique to design. I mean, even, you know, an accountant, you review what somebody has spent lots of time on, and if you're only critical, that will impact their response to you. So just starting with something positive and then having the real conversation about criticism with the criticism. But at least you start in a good place where you both appreciate and respect each other.
Creatives are so different from the people who hire them, I think, in a lot of cases. Are there certain words or things that you should never use with a creative?
I mean, I think what the biggest difference is, we're more emotionally attached to the work that we're doing. So we're emotionally invested in it, like which I think is different from people in corporations. Maybe they don't care. So sometimes we feel like we care more than our clients about the outcome or about the specifics or the details. In terms of words, I think I have a chapter about words.
You do, yeah.
So I have a chapter called "Don't Say This, Don't Say That, Say This." And part of that is, you know, don't say "make it red." Say instead, "I wish it were bolder and stronger." That's about not giving us the solution, but set up what you wish it was. Don't say "make it yellow." Say "I wish it were sunnier," because maybe we'll come up with a better solution. Maybe yellow isn't the right thing to do, but, you know, using an incredibly bright photo. But if you limit us to that one solution and we just end up following orders, you lose our creativity that we can bring to it.
I always found that my vision sometimes didn't match what the vision was from the client, from the person hiring me. Why is it important to have everybody on the same page with the vision?
Exactly for that reason, so you don't waste anybody's time. So a creative brief, a discussion up front, visual references are sometimes helpful, but really to talk about what the goal of the project is, who the audience is, and what you want it to bring out in people, what the goal of the project is. And then, you know, understanding the boundaries. It's a service industry. Graphic design is a service industry. So we want to please you. This isn't fine art where we just want to go off and, you know, have a blank canvas and do whatever we feel like it. We're following the restrictions are actually what's exciting. What are the boundaries for what we're doing? So being on the same page to begin with, hopefully you're hired for a specific reason because they like your work. They appreciate the way you think. And then just make sure the brief is explicit about what they're looking for.
And not only is it just about that vision and sort of the outline of things to do, but it's also about money, budget, time spent. It seems like those were always moving goalposts when I was doing this.
Yeah, it's very important to have that stuff established up front. And honestly, again, we care so much. I'm speaking generally, of course, but that oftentimes we want to do the 10th round because we want to make it better, but we really should be paid for the 10th round. So I think having a contract, laying out all the steps and being incredibly honest about all of that with each other, having those difficult conversations about money, that goes for both sides, is absolutely crucial.
And is it easier to do when you have your meeting in person? I, for a time, was involved with a website that would basically put me in a fishbowl, and I would be selected to do a job for the gig economy. It was awful.
Yeah, that's a terrible. That's not design. That's something else. I highly recommend meeting in person. Talking on the phone, even doing video chat, is different from being in a room with someone, especially for the first meeting. I know you can't meet every time, and that's fine, but you need to create that relationship, and being in the same room does it.
You've talked a little bit about collaboration here. There's so many different ways that people are collaborating nowadays. There's software that enables you to do it in real time, almost instantaneously. Is that good or bad from the standpoint?
What kind of collaboration are
you
talking about?
You know, the software that I'm thinking of enables people to collaborate in real time so they can see, make changes to what you're talking about.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. No, I mean, the designer is the one with the files and they have to handle the files.
Yeah.
Period. They can get the comments because things, even when you change, you know, anything, even the third line needs to change. It affects the rag. It affects lots of different things, the balance of whatever it is that you're doing. So it's important to trust the designer to do those things and not try and do it yourself. And just going back to your previous question, one of the most important things in the book is nothing takes a second. That gets mentioned all the time. Could you just do this thing? It'll just take a second. There is literally nothing that takes a second. And what they think takes a second could be 3 hours of a designer's time, which is not nothing. And so it's sort of disrespectful to say this is no big deal, even though it is. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it is 3 hours of your time to do it.
So oftentimes companies will say, we want something iconic. We want you to be the next something, something, something.
Yes.
How many times have you heard that, and how do you write about dealing with that?
Well, I mean, people often reference Nike and Apple, but it's more because Nike and Apple are so successful. I mean, they've huge marketing budgets, so that's why they're iconic, because you see their identities everywhere. But I often wonder whether a company that hires, you know, that hires me for a logo, how they would respond to the Nike swoosh, for example, if I presented it. They would say, what does it mean? What does it say? Like, it's just a line with a curve. I don't understand why you would even present that. But they look at it now and think, there's a great logo, because the company is so great.
Oftentimes, this client-designer relationship is strained by, you don't want to make somebody angry because you might want to work with them again. But how do you be firm
A designer or as a client?
Either way, but I'm talking more of as a designer. How do you be firm to say, okay, these are my boundaries. This is what I'm charging. This is how long it's going to take. So you don't make a client angry.
I mean, I think contracts really can take care of all of that, and you hope for the best and you plan for the worst. So you include, if it goes beyond 5 rounds, you include what happens if you fire me in the middle of the job, but I've already invested all this time. Who owns the work at that point? You negotiate all of that in the contract before the creative work begins. Never begin work without a contract. And it really benefits both sides. There's a clear understanding. Everybody's playing by the same rules, and everybody knows how it's going to go down. But again, we're so enthusiastic, and we want to do the job so much. Often we just start right away. We get emotionally invested. Then we give up and say, okay, you don't have to pay me for any overages. Everybody's bitter in the end, and yeah, it's just a bad situation.
What else do you want them to know?
Stuff that isn't in the book?
No, stuff that is in the book. Like, what are some of your other favorites?
Oh, okay. Experiences in everything is a huge one. We would get asked, you know, we'd get a call for a job and say, well, have you done, you know, packaging for toothpaste before? Well, you don't need to have done packaging for toothpaste before to do packaging for toothpaste. Design is about problem solving. So it's about understanding the issues, understanding the parameters, understanding the competition. We do a full round of research before we begin any project. And so really, to me, it's beneficial to have never done it before because you don't know what it should be. And so the field is wide open. Like, well, why don't we look at it from a completely different standpoint? Whereas if I did toothpaste packaging night and day, I would be like, oh, let's do solution number 4 this time.
You also write about how experience is in everything. I know a lot of folks like to say, well, you know, in my experience, this is... But you write that there's always a unique solution to a big problem sometimes.
Yeah, and not doing it all the time, I think, opens up the possibility for a brand new way of looking at something. And that's, in design, that's beneficial. Who wants to be exactly like their competition?
I heard the other day, and you could comment on this if you want, but I think it was in a Reddit discussion where the person said, graphic design really isn't art. Would you agree with that?
Isn't art?
Is not art.
It's somewhere between art and commerce. Graphic design is somewhere between art and commerce. My husband is an artist, and nothing makes him happier than just a blank canvas. Like, he can do anything he wants. Nothing scares me more than a blank canvas. I need those restrictions. I need those rules and regulations. What am I trying to do? Give me an assignment, and I thrive. Give me a blank piece of paper, I don't know what to do.
So the goal of people reading this book is to have happy designers and clients.
Exactly.
Talk to me a little bit about your experience in real life. I know you've done work for some major brands. What would we recognize?
Probably the most famous thing is Saturday Night Live, where I worked with them for 20 years. Also the Late Show with Jimmy Fallon, and now the Late Show with Seth Meyers. I did the opening titles for Will and Grace, both series, current and old. But that's just because TV is so much bigger. I was the creative director at Newsweek for a while, and I've done brand identities for some major companies, This American Life and StoryCorps, and you know, lots of different things. Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation.
How has the industry changed in good ways and bad ways over the years?
Well, as you know, I started my company with a partner when I was 30, so it was very different then. First of all, now so much can be done remotely. We used to have meetings, like back-to-back meetings, but now that everything can be sent online, that's amazing. That's been life-changing for freeing up time. more, I think, the industry changes when you have experience. So having a company for 25 years, people trust me more than they did when I was 30. So that's really terrific. It's great getting older.
And to designers, would you offer what advice to them?
Oh my gosh, just do what you love to do. I mean, really, that's for everybody. I feel like if you can find the thing you love to do, it won't ever be work.
Yeah, it's wonderful meeting you. I enjoyed the book, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning, 5:30. Great stuff from Steve and Bonnie. Do what you want to do in life. That is a beautiful thing.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. MHub, an innovation space for Chicago's hardware startups, celebrated its one-year anniversary on Friday. Over the last year, nearly 200 startups and 650 Chicagoans have worked out of MHub, launching over 235 products and generating nearly $20 million in revenue. AOP, an app that lets users anonymously submit and answer a range of questions across a variety of topics, like politics and entertainment, has found a way to completely eliminate online trolls through its multiple-choice polls. The app has more than 16,000 users who voted on questions over 10 million times. And Chicago-area tech company Metrom Rail won New York City's Genius Transit Challenge, which looks at innovative solutions to modernize and improve New York City's subway service. The startup's technology provides an increase in train operating efficiency and safety with significant reductions in cost and deployment. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, 5:41. Steve Cochran Show coming up at the top of the hour. My name is Mark Carmen, in for Steve this morning. Let's bring in our second guest of the morning, Ivan Eland. He's the Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. And we're going to talk about the United States and North Korea and denationalization talk this morning. Ivan, good morning. Thank you for taking time, first off. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
So, all right. The word on the street here, Ivan, is that the U.S. is not going to make any concessions to North Korea and leader Kim Jong-un. And I guess all sorts of concessions are going to be coming back, including ceasing nuclear and missile testing. This sounds like a win for the U.S., but is this actually, from what you're seeing, is this realistic as to how this is going to go down the line? Apparently, the two leaders are going to meet at some point here, perhaps in May.
Yeah, I think, you know, in any negotiation, if you want to get anywhere, there's going to have to be some sort of a compromise. People go into it with their idea of what's going on. And the United States kind of had the curious position for many years that we're not going to start talking with North Korea until they agree to do what we want, which is denuclearize. You know, there'd be a commitment to do that. That was kind of a strange position. Now, we have had problems negotiating with them in the past. And it hasn't been all their fault, but it has been a lot of their fault. And so we have to approach this very cautiously. And, of course, the president's not really doing that because that's not the way he operates. But, you know, I think this is probably better than what the alternative was. I mean, they were headed towards war, I think. And so that, and I don't mean to be overly dramatic about that. There's a lot of people who work at the Pentagon that I know that we're saying that that was where they were going. So I think this is, you know, much better than that.
Well, you mentioned the past, Ivan. I mean, you can go back to 1994, and there was the agreed framework. And, you know, under that agreement, North Korea stopped construction of two reactors that could produce fuel for nuclear weapons. In exchange, they got a promise of two. They got more oil and two light water nuclear reactors that could produce energy, but not weapons fuel. So, I mean, that was it. Now, they, to your point, they never really followed through on that. At least they did for a little while, but then they backed off and started going back towards wanting to create nuclear weapons. So, I mean, I'm assuming there will be something here, but you also have, you know, a whole lot of people within, you know, around Donald Trump who don't want to give anything to North Korea. So, how do you think that looks?
Well, I think it looks to them, they from their perspective, if you look, you know, you can dismiss them as a crazy country that, you know, we need to go to war with. But in fact, they haven't been really that crazy. They've sort of adopted Richard Nixon's madman theory that to try to make people think they're crazy, because their actions, they've been doing the same thing basically for decades. And U.S. presidents keep falling into it. We always try to give them concessions to get them to do something. But really, nuclear weapons, they look out and they see the history of U.S. overthrowing Milosevic in Syria, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya after he gave up his nuclear program. And they also see Ukraine, who willingly gave up its nuclear program. And, of course, they got invaded by Russia. So they see all these countries that, you know, don't have nuclear weapons anymore, and they have they're having problems with other countries. And so that's one factor. The other thing is, I think they've always wanted a meeting with the United States. Now, Trump seems to be giving them that without any concessions, which is a little strange, because usually the head of state summit is the last after you've negotiated the treaty, and it's just sort of a formality of the signing. But that's really what they want. And so if they meet, I suppose all the pundits are saying, well, you know, we'll be giving them something. We're not getting anything in return, which is true. But the alternative here, I think, sometimes we get too involved in who's up and who's down, and maybe that we should just negotiate. So in this case, if Trump does it right, he could break open the whole issue simply because of his own unorthodox way of doing it. Now, of course, he's got to study, got to prepare, and he's got to have experts, and those are all in doubt at this point, the way he operates. So if he does it right, he might be, you know, we had to have a severe anti-communist in Richard Nixon go to China. And the analogy isn't exactly there, but it's you know, Nixon had to think out of the box, and then Trump is certainly doing that if it comes to fruition. I think it's going to be harder to get this meeting up and running than one might think, since a lot of people are telling that Trump now, well, you know, you kind of made a mistake by agreeing to do this without getting anything in return. So now they're trying to backfill. That doesn't work very well. You know, they're trying to back up and say, well, hey, he's got to do this, this, and that, when it appeared before that he just said, look, neat.
Ivan Ehlen, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. You mentioned China real fast, Ivan. China would love to see the U.S. and North Korea sit down, correct? I mean, they have a lot of interest in this.
Yeah, well, China has a lot of trade now with South Korea, and I think China, to some extent, regards North Korea as like a fraternity legacy that you have to take into the chapter, but you don't really want to. You know, it's an ally, but it causes them a lot of problems, and they're really trying to tame North Korea down a bit. And they have agreed to sanctions, and there's more sanctions that China's put on than ever before. But they don't want the regime to collapse either, because that gives them a lot of refugees. It may have it may cause the reunification of the peninsula with U.S. intelligence facilities on the Yalu River, which we know how sensitive the Chinese are about enemy forces or intelligence sites on the Yalu River, because that's what triggered the Chinese invasion in the Korean War, which, you know, the U.S. had to retreat back to the 38th parallel. So anyway, they're very sensitive about that border. But at the same time, the Koreans cause them a lot of problems because they provoke the United States. The United States feels it needs to put more forces in that area to offset Korea. And of course, the Chinese would like less U.S. forces or fewer U.S. forces in that area, because they're an expanding power. They want to become a power in their own right. So basically what the Chinese have said is that if U.S. attacks North Korea, China will have to come to its aid. But if North Korea attacks the South, it's on its own. The Chinese have been very clear about that policy. It's sort of an ally that they have to defend. And, you know, it goes against their trading relationships with South Korea, which are very lucrative, because the South now has 40 times the GDP of the North, which, of course, leads us, if we really want to ask the big question is, why are we still there defending South Korea when they're much richer than the destitute, starving nation? Perhaps we should wean them off our defense umbrella. Of course, that's why he's developing a long-range missile, so that he can threaten the United States. Bill Clinton was going to negotiate that away, but decided that he couldn't accept it because they wouldn't get rid of the short-range missiles which threatened our allies. So that's sort of letting the alliance lead the way in our thinking. But, you know, we've always done that, and so we have pledged to defend South Korea and Japan, but we've never really questioned whether those alliances are out of date nowadays. But, you know, that's a larger issue, but it does impinge on this whole North and South Korea thing.
Well, Ivan, you're all over it. Appreciate the time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ivan Ehlund, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. 5:55, Steve Cochran Show coming right up. But first, let's get to the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Looks like it's going to be a robust day on Wall Street. Dow futures ticking up 109 points this morning. The S&P up nearly 11 points. NASDAQ up 43 points this morning, as again, looking for a big day on Wall Street. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities with Orion Samuelson.
As we start this trading week, getting close to the beginning of spring, we are looking at some more pressure on the soybean market. It was a tough day on Friday, with soybeans falling more than 20 cents a bushel. And in the overnight trade on this Monday, soybean futures are lower, hitting a more than two-week low. Meanwhile, livestock futures Friday, the April live cattle contract, gained $1.47 a hundredweight. The April feeder cattle contract up 22 cents, but the June lean hog contract ended the day down 79 cents a hundredweight. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thank you, Orion. Let's take a look at what we can expect today for Monday, March 12th. The Treasury Department shares details on the monthly U.S. budget, likely providing insight into the impact on this year's tax cuts. Eglet Corporation reports earnings during pre-market hours today, while Stitch Fix and industrial provider Kronos Worldwide report earnings after the bell. Those are just some of the things that could move the markets on Monday, March the 12th.